These voices made headlines this week.
Funny thing happened to me on the way out to Chicago.
This is a great event. I'm as happy as I can be to have had a part in it.
The ABC Radio Network presents Voices in the Headlines. The sounds of the news this week gathered from around the world by the staff of ABC Radio News.
For Fred Foy, this is Les Griffiths with Voices in the Headlines. For almost two decades, the world has lived in a dark, unnerving shadow. The shadow cast by the blinding flash that marked the dawn of the nuclear age. No day followed that dawn, only a long night of multiplying fears. Fears over the outcome of a contest called the arms race. This week, at the initiative of the United States, East and West took a common step that could lead to a slackening of that race. The announcement came on Monday. In New York City, President Johnson broke the news to a convention of news editors.
I have ordered a substantial reduction in our production of enriched uranium to be carried out over a four-year period. When added to previous reductions, this will mean an overall decrease in the production of plutonium by 20%. And of enriched uranium by 40%.
A substantial cutback in the production of nuclear explosives. A cutback which, Mr. Johnson revealed, the Kremlin had agreed to match.
Chairman Khrushchev is releasing a statement in Moscow at 2 o'clock our time, in which he makes definite commitments to steps toward a more peaceful world.
And promptly at 2 o'clock, Khrushchev made his promised announcement. The slowdown in Russia's atomic explosives output, as described to the world by Radio Moscow, was to be made in two steps, one now, one later.
Right now, to stop the construction of two new major atomic reactors for producing plutonium. To reduce considerably in the next few years the production of uranium-235 for nuclear weapons.
Back in New York, President Johnson added that Great Britain could be expected to take similar action. But the chief executive cautioned that the three-power action was only one small step down a long road.
This is not disarmament. This is not a declaration of peace. But it is a hopeful sign, and it is a step forward which we welcome and which we can take. In the hope that the world may yet one day live without the fear of war.
While the new agreement will slow the growth of nuclear stockpiles, the United States and the Soviet Union retain the already stockpiled ability to incinerate the face of the earth. UN Secretary General U Thant bore that grim fact in mind as he evaluated this week's accord.
What is more significant than the actual decisions is the obvious manifestation of mutual confidence shown by the three governments, and thus the international atmosphere is further improved.
There was even hope this week that an improved Cold War climate might stimulate the paralyzed disarmament conference in Geneva. Adrian Fisher, the chief American negotiator at the Geneva talks, told ABC News that
these announcements demonstrate the validity of the view, which I know is generally held at this conference, that with patience and persistence in our search for ways to halt and turn down the arms race, it is possible to take concrete steps to reach this goal.
While there was no immediate breakthrough in Geneva, President Johnson told a White House news conference on Saturday that Washington and Moscow are corresponding on the possibility of further agreements aimed at lessening tensions. On one frontier of the East-West confrontation, tensions this week were mounting rather than lessening. Ever since the 1962 missile crisis, U.S. reconnaissance planes have made periodic flights over Cuba. A State Department spokesman explained why those missions have been necessary.
First, I would recall that the overflights are a substitute for the on-site inspection agreed to by the Soviets in October 1962, but which Fidel Castro refused to permit. Second, I would point out that the surveillance flights are thoroughly based on the resolution approved by the Organization of American States on October 23, 1962.
The detachments of Russian troops stationed on Cuba since 1962 had tacitly accepted the U.S. insistence on its right to make overflights of the island. But now, virtually all of that Soviet force has left Cuba, and the batteries of modern, deadly, accurate anti-aircraft missiles they installed are slated to be turned over to Fidel Castro. And Castro this week announced he'll use those guns to down any American planes that venture over Cuba. Washington's reply to Castro's threat? It came from President Johnson.
I do think that it is essential that we maintain surveillance and know whether any missiles are being shipped into Cuba, and we will have to maintain our reconnaissance and our overflights. And any action on their part to stop that would be a very serious action, and we have so informed them and informed their friends.
But that warning may have fallen on deaf ears in Havana. Idaho Senator Frank Church, a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, warned that the Cuban premier might still carry out his threat.
This is a danger, particularly because, as we know, Castro is very eccentric and he might, in a fit of pique, decide to shoot down one of the planes that we are overflying Cuba with, and that could cause a serious crisis.
And if a serious crisis does arise between Washington and Havana, where will Russia stand? An answer came late this week from Radio Moscow.
The flights of American aircraft over Cuba run counter to the agreement between the United States and the Soviet Union concerning the liquidation of the Caribbean crisis in October 1962. As for the Soviet weapons which are in the hands of the Cuban army, Cuba has the right to arm itself with such weapons to provide for its own security.
Armed with Moscow's declaration of support, Castro stepped up his verbal attacks against the United States. On Friday, his government asked UN Secretary General Thant for action to force a halt to the American overflights. Southeast Asia was another part of the world that caused some furrowed brows this week in Washington. On Monday, Secretary of State Dean Rusk flew home from a first-hand inspection of strife-torn South Vietnam. Microphones were set up at plane side, and Mr. Rusk told newsmen,
"In Saigon, I was much encouraged because although there are some provinces which are still critical, there are others that are showing steady improvement. General Khan and his government are on the right track. Everyone there is in good morale. They know what the job is to be done, and they're doing it."
Still, dispatches from Vietnam made it clear that the armies under General Khan are primarily on the defensive, beating off Viet Cong attacks rather than driving the Red Guerrillas out of the country. Another recent American visitor to Saigon, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, conceded that it will take time for General Khan to switch to the offensive.
"I think it'll be several months before we see any substantial progress. I think I said when I came back in March that it would be 4 to 6 months before any dramatic progress was visible."
And President Johnson admitted this week that there is still some tough going ahead in Vietnam.
"But there is an old American saying that when the going gets tough, the tough get going. So let no one doubt that we are in this battle as long as South Vietnam wants our support and needs our assistance to protect its freedom."
Washington's attention was also focused this week on Vietnam's neighbor, Laos, where right-wing leaders continued to insist on a bigger voice in the coalition regime. The same kind of tenacious determination President Johnson voices over troubles abroad got results this week on the domestic front. It was a plainly proud and relieved Lyndon Johnson who went on nationwide radio and TV Wednesday to announce that the nation's railroads and operating employees had finally made their peace.
This settlement ends 4.5 years of conflict and controversy. I tell you quite frankly, there are few events that give me more faith in my country and more pride in the free collective bargaining process.
The settlement had been hammered out after almost 2 weeks of last-ditch bargaining. Bargaining conducted in the shadow of the White House under almost constant presidential supervision. Hanging over the bargainers, the president and the nation, the threat of an economy crippling coast-to-coast strike by 200,000 on-train workers represented by 5 operating unions. The years-old dispute had defied solution by the courts, by the Congress, by arbitration boards. And when settlement was finally reached this week, both management and labor bargainers were quick to attribute the breakthrough to Mr. Johnson's personal intervention. Chief Management Negotiator J.E. Wolfe told Washington newsmen,
"On behalf of the nation's railroads, I applaud President Johnson's handling of this dispute. We are deeply grateful for his statesmanship that led to today's settlement, which should have a wholesome effect on collective bargaining, both in railroading and other industries."
Speaking for the operating unions, Brotherhood official Roy Davidson.
"We're grateful that the president has encouraged collective bargaining to function as one of our free democratic processes. The groundwork for collective bargaining in the railroad industry has been reestablished. We hope it will promote true cooperation and meaningful communication between labor and management."
Principal terms of the agreement: for management, more control over the size of work crews and over assignment of work duties for employees. For the union members, 7 paid holidays annually and pay raises for about 100,000 rail workers. On Friday, President Johnson made a whirlwind tour of the poverty-stricken Appalachian area. His objectives: to get first-hand views of the consequences of high unemployment and low income, and to familiarize the people of Appalachia with his declared war on poverty. At every stop along his itinerary, the president was greeted by enthusiastic crowds. At South Bend, Indiana, he visited a school where displaced workers are being retrained for new jobs. A cheering throng of 15,000 almost mobbed Mr. Johnson and came to order only when the president spoke to them.
"When I go back to Washington, I'm going to say to the leaders of that great capital that I wish they could come here in the heartland of America and see what the people are doing for themselves, see what the people want to do for their families. And we're going to try to refuse to take no for an answer and get in here and do something ourselves about it. Thank you for coming out here and giving us this reception."
From South Bend, the president flew on to Pittsburgh. First appointment there, a convention of the League of Women Voters, from whose ranks Mr. Johnson solicited volunteers to help fight the war on poverty.
"Dedicated Americans will have the opportunity to enlist as volunteers. And I expect the women of America to be the first to enlist in this war on poverty for the benefit of their children, not only for this generation, but the children of future generations."
And then crosstown to the meeting hall of a Pittsburgh local of the Steelworkers Union.
"I'm here to fight an enemy. I'm here to tell you that I intend to not only start that fight, but keep up that fight until that enemy has been routed and destroyed. And that enemy is unemployment."
From Pittsburgh, the president hurried on to the Kentucky towns of Inez and Paintsville, 2 towns representative of the darkest of the Appalachian poverty pockets. Later, Mr. Johnson conferred with the governors of the states in the depressed region, heard their hopes and recommendations for revitalizing the area, and then flew back to Washington. Next day, the president announced plans to ask Congress for $1 billion to underwrite a variety of work projects aimed at ending the economic blight in Appalachia. Mr. Johnson's original anti-poverty proposals went to Capitol Hill earlier this year. The bill is under study in the House Education and Labor Committee, chaired by Harlem Congressman Adam Clayton Powell. This week, Mr. Powell voiced optimism over the bill's future.
I think that the war on poverty measure, which is right now before my committee, will pass the House, and I'm sure it will pass the Senate. And I really feel that it's going to help cut down the filibuster against civil rights, because the Southern senators who are filibustering against the civil rights program are the ones who want the war on poverty program in their states.
Nevertheless, the civil rights bill remained at a standstill all this week in the Senate. Outwardly, there was no sign that the measure was any closer to passage than it had been a month ago. Still, Senate Democratic Whip Hubert Humphrey, floor manager of the bill, found some cause for optimism.
We're in the amendment process now, which is a part of the legislative process. And I believe that we're well on the way towards the passage of a very meaningful and effective civil rights bill.
But at week's end, the bill's future seemed even more uncertain, as Tennessee Senator Albert Gore, a Southern liberal who voted for the 1957 and 1960 civil rights bills, said that the measure now under debate is seriously defective and potentially dangerous. Wednesday, April 22nd, the day dawned wet, dull, and cold in New York City. That fact, plus the sit-in, stand-in, and stall-in demonstrations planned by militant civil rights factions, offered a dismal prospect for the scheduled inauguration of the New York World's Fair. But the hour appointed for the highway stall-in came and passed. The demonstration failed to materialize, and traffic flowed freely over the access arteries leading to the fair. And despite the foul weather, a respectable crowd was on hand as the inaugural parade moved up the Midway. A crowd of 10,000 filed into a rain and wind-swept stadium on the fairgrounds for opening day speeches. Speeches by government dignitaries, fair officials, and a former haberdasher from Independence, Missouri.
This is a great event. I'm as happy as I can be to have had a part in it. You're as kind as you can be to ask an old has-been to come here and help you on an occasion of this kind. And I'm glad that you remember what I have been and not what I am today.
And minutes later, the man who is today what Harry Truman used to be walked into the stadium and strode toward the speaker's platform. President Johnson told the throng that the United States stands on the brink of a bright tomorrow, a day full of promise and adventure. But the president warned that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow will have to be earned.
Unless we can achieve the theme of this fair, peace through understanding, unless we can use our skill and our wisdom to conquer conflict as we have conquered science, then our hopes of today, these proud achievements, will go under in the devastation of tomorrow.
And then the president moved on to the Pavilion of the United States for ribbon-cutting ceremonies. There, too, Mr. Johnson spoke, but his words were nearly drowned out by a disturbance on the edge of the crowd, a band of civil rights demonstrators shouting militant integration slogans. The president ignored them, stared straight ahead, finished his address, and flew back to Washington. As the day wore on at the fair, hundreds of other demonstrators staged sit-in and lie-in appearances at some of the commercial and state exhibition buildings. City police and fair security guards carried the demonstrators away. Not all of them submitted quietly.
This is Birmingham, New York. Police.
All in all, some 300 demonstrators were arrested, among them James Farmer, National Director of CORE, and Bayard Rustin, organizer of last summer's March on Washington. In Washington, next day, at a White House news conference, President Johnson was asked for comment on the raucous disturbance during his appearance at the fair.
I noticed a few people yesterday that, and there were very few, who seemed insistent on being rude, and I pity them. They serve no good purpose, either promoting the cause that they profess to support or of disrupting that cause.
Sandwiched in among his busy hours of foreign policy addresses, news conferences, and attention to the myriad other details of his office, President Johnson found time this week for some plain, unvarnished politicking. On Thursday night, he spoke to a Democratic fundraising rally in Chicago.
A funny thing happened to me on the way out to Chicago. I passed Dick Nixon coming back from Vietnam. And Barry Goldwater and Nelson Rockefeller going out. Harold Stassen was trying to hitchhike a ride. And Bill Scranton insisted that he doesn't plan to go. But if he changes his mind, he'll just walk.
In the final analysis, the president said, it won't matter much which candidate snares the GOP nomination. Back in Washington on Saturday, another veteran Democratic campaigner offered some election year views. Former President Truman presided over one of his now famous sidewalk news conferences. ABC's Richard Bate had this question for the Dyed in the Wool Democrat.
Who do you think President Johnson's going to choose as his running mate?
Ask him.
That's a good answer.
That's an answer to you.
It is indeed.
The only man in the country can select a vice president is the president himself.
Another question. Had the years mellowed Mr. Truman's attitude toward Richard Nixon?
I don't know anything about Mr. Nixon. I have no interest in him, whatever.
And what about this year's presidential election? How big a victory did he foresee for President Johnson?
If he's going to win, maybe 2-1, who are they going to take? Going to take Goldwater?
Who do you think they're going to take?
I'm not going to nominate any Republicans for him, but whoever they nominate, we'll beat the hell out of him, so what?
And what about those political polls, like the ones which had predicted that Mr. Truman would lose to Tom Dewey back in 1948? Are the polls more accurate these days than they were then?
No. I'll tell you why. If you walk down here with me, and I won't say a word, and ask the first people you meet how they feel and who they're for president, and right off the reel will tell you. And when they go in to vote, they won't pay attention to what they said to you. I know from experience.
And speaking of Tom Dewey, Mr. Truman had recently renewed acquaintance with the 1948 GOP candidate in a chance meeting at a New York City theater. The natural question...
How was your meeting with Mr. Dewey the other night backstage at the
very pleasant.
See him as a Republican dark horse?
I don't know anything about what the Republicans are going to do, and I told you I didn't give a damn.
How do you know?
So went this world this week, and the voices in the headlines. Voices in the Headlines, a presentation of ABC Radio News, written and produced by Richard Dressel. Directed by Len Magnus. Executive producer, Tom O'Brien. Audio engineering by Jerry Sheen, Jerry Zeller, and Pete Sarantopoulos. Your narrator today, Les Griffith. Carl Caruso speaking.